Howdy, y'all. My name is Myers Raymer, and I'm an alcoholic.
Myers.
What a treat. I only got two nasty emails during the week. I was a little disappointed, but I'll do better tonight. Did you start that little, gosh darn it? Okay, you're a professional. I'm sorry. Forgive me. Is Vic here tonight? Vic Ekholm? Okay, I called him Vince twice last week, and afterwards he's looking at me like he's just sitting right here. He's looking at me and he goes, "It's Vic." And I went, "Oh, I know it is. We covered a bunch of stuff last week, and we did a bunch of stuff that I always feel is necessary in the beginning of that stuff. We'll be more on track and more focused tonight on what we're doing. Matter of fact, we'll go fast enough that some of you guys will be going, slow down. There's just a lot to cover. Two quick pieces of house cleaning from last week that I want to cover. One, we start these shenanigans talking about that stuff that they talk about on page 17, this thing about a common solution. And somewhere along the line, I think that we've drifted sideways off this idea of a common solution. We've gotten this. It's like we all just discovered the age of enlightenment, and it's all about us, and it's all about however we want to do it, and so we end up with this weirdness going on of talking about. If you don't believe that this is true, start paying attention to what you're hearing everywhere you go. Some of you guys audit a lot of other meetings, and you go to these meetings, and when you're sitting there, I'm not saying it from a point of judgment, we're not trying to judge anybody, but just listen to what you hear and see how different and varied and diverse the stuff that you're hearing. Some of it's good, some of it's not so good, some of it's downright like, what? What? I mean, come on. And so that was the reason why Bill and those cats spent so much time trying to get us kind of pulled back around. They wrote this stuff down in text form so that we wouldn't do that, so that you could actually take the book, give it to somebody, they could work the work, and there you were. Everything about this thing, the fellowship is cool, the everything that joins us in terms that we're all a big old den of drunks, and there's a bunch of little dope fiends running around, and it's all a bunch of whack jobs, and it's just, and it's groovy, it's cool, it's the fabric that this whole thing is made from, but that's not holding us together. What's holding us together is the underlying baseline that is the steps and the resulting work that comes from the steps, this connection with God as we understand Him. And so that's the reason why it takes on some importance. The reason I'm saying this is because, guys, as you work with brand new guys and brand new gals, and as you're working through this stuff, it's our responsibility to go, is this text or is this an opinion? If we're all going to drag this stuff back on track, we're going to have to each individually become able to judge ourselves as to whether or not what we're sharing is opinion that we've been spoon-fed in AA meetings, or is this book. It's the reason why I'm such a fan of big book studies, and why I'm such a big fan of anything that has to do with getting back into the basic text as what sets the baseline for what it is that we do and what it is that we teach. Otherwise, we're going to end up where we are, which is tens of thousands of us out there teaching varied and really divergent ideas about how to get sober. Meeting makers make it. Well, okay, I understand that. Where does that say that in the text? It doesn't. And you're looking at an old crusty guy that almost died in meetings, six meetings a week, and I'm a dead man. I mean, I'm just. Let me ask you a question. Did any of you guys, were any of you guys like me that you never thought about suicide until you got to AA? It's the craziest thing. I mean, I'm 7 years from my last drink, and I can't go a single day without contemplating for at least some period of time during the day what it would be like to kill myself. 7 years from my last drink. That's crazy. And you go, well, I'm a success today because I didn't drink today. No, you're not. You're an idiot. I mean, it's just, come on. This is the stuff that we're trying to keep people from doing. Remember, statistically, and then we'll get on track here. Statistically, we have so few people staying any appreciable amount of time, and nobody wants to look at it. Nobody wants to say, hey, why aren't they staying? And they're not staying for a reason. They're not staying because they're not hearing what they need to hold them here. Let me tell you something. I don't care how pithy your story is. I don't care how awesome it is. Once you've heard it 50 times, it's not awesome anymore. Listen, I know it's still awesome for you because you're telling it, but for the rest of us, it's tedious. It's painful. We know what happened. Quit. Instead of telling your story in a meeting again, why don't you try telling people how you sobered up, what you did as a result of doing this work, what happened, how has your life changed today as a direct result of the loving hand of God changing everything about your life? Wouldn't that be cooler? I think it would. You don't have to do that, honest, you don't. What I'm hoping through the next two weeks, is that what we'll do is we'll begin to reevaluate what we say, and that we'll think twice before we say things flippantly. Meeting makers make it. Some don't, guys. Some die. The meeting, as we sell the idea that the meeting is the most important thing to newcomers coming in, watch what happens. A lot of that depends on what? Where they go to meetings. What happens if they're going to a meeting where we got the weird whack people with the dolls that we were talking about last week? What do you do then? You kiss them goodbye. You're talking about a deadly disease. We bury lots of people that get into this situation. And it's an ugly cul-de-sac. And unless we can figure out some way to get them clear, unless we can figure out a way to get them on track, and just telling them to go to a meeting. Hallelujah. I agree with that. I agree. I thought Jesus would have a deeper voice, though. It's like, all right, you get that. Let's start. Turn to page 44. This is a weird place to start, but we're going to start at that first chapter on page 44. We closed with it last week, and we'll pick up with it tonight. I'm going to skip down a couple of lines. If they're going to tell us what makes an alcoholic. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. Or when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. Two things. It didn't have anything to do with the war stories. It didn't have anything to do with whether you got a DWI or whether you were in jail or whether you were molested or whether you were a Vietnam vet or whether you were... It had nothing to do with any of that. I'm not making light of any of it. Save those emails. I'm not making light of it. What I'm saying is that it didn't define you as an alcoholic. What defined you as an alcoholic? That you lost the power of choice and control. Choice and control. So, you come home and you tell your wife, listen, I'm never drinking again. And 2 weeks later you find yourself driving home with a beer between your legs. You've lost the power of choice. Dig? You may have said, I decided to do it, but I'm telling you right now, you've lost the power of choice. And so, let's say you call your wife and you say, start dinner, I'm heading home, I'm going to stop by this place, I'm going to drink one beer with these guys, and then I'm going to be home, and it's all going to be groovy. And then you drink 12, 10, whatever it takes, and you come home at midnight, you've lost the power of control. Once I start, I can't stop. And that's it. The rest of this stuff is just, if we see, what I'm trying to do is, if we get this thing all back down simple the way it is, then identifying and helping somebody see that comes in brand new, helping them see their truth around their alcoholism becomes really clear. It becomes real easy to understand. We don't have to confuse it with a bunch of conflicting information. I used the example last week. It's like those story problems that they give you. Do they still do that stuff where they give you a whole bunch of information and a thing, and about half the information? I was already glazed over. The moment they said math, I was already drooling on my desk. I was just like... But it's one of those kind of deals where they give you a bunch of information that's not important. That all it does is just distract you, and pretty soon you're off in the tulies chasing rabbits that don't have anything to do with the problem. That's exactly the way we face these situations a lot of times in AA. When people try to make AA like it's half behavior problem, half disease, half... Of family of origin issue, half this, half, and pretty soon, you understand what I'm saying? We just get all twisted up. It has nothing to do with family of origin issues. It has nothing to do with the rest of this stuff. These may be issues that we need to deal with, but it has nothing to do with alcoholism as we understand it. Pretty simple. From where we left off reading, read this next line. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which what? Only a spiritual experience will conquer. This is classic Bill Wilson, declarative statement with no gray area. There's no interpretation. There's no, you get it. It's telling us exactly how we're going to get from point A to point B. So, which brings us to step two stuff is, as an identifying what it is, if this thing is about God, that there's a power greater than us that could fix this deal, do we have to identify it? Not necessarily. They make it real clear. Listen, guys and gals that come into this fellowship come in two schools. At least in my experience, they come in two schools. They either believe in this stuff or they don't believe in this stuff. They either believe that there's a God that's bigger than them out there, or they don't believe that there's a God out there. You see what I'm saying? It's either one or the other one. Now, the weird part about this is that we get so weird about this stuff is, I don't know, there may be three people in this entire room that came in here that didn't have God sideways in their crawl. I mean, listen, if I'm out there on the street acting a fool, doing crazy things, the last thing I want in my life is God. I don't want to answer to one more guy. I don't want to have to do anything else. I just would like to be... And so most of us just sort of come in here like that. It's not that I hate God. It's not. I just don't want to deal with Him. Thank you. But there are very few real atheists. We run across a few. I mean, the whole time I've been sponsoring guys, and we're talking hundreds and hundreds of men that I've worked through, work with in the steps, I've had one bona fide atheist. And if you get you a bona fide atheist... I don't know, I'll tell you a story real quick. There was this guy that... It's a quick story, honest. There was this guy one time that I was working with, and he was one of the coolest kids you ever saw in your whole life, just as nice as he could be. A little whack looking, but he was okay. And we were talking, and I kept... We're working the work, and we're working the steps, and he talks about a God, and this we're kind of working all through this stuff, but he's not making any progress. It's like fail the launch. You know, he's just like, every day he seems to be getting worse and worse and worse, and he's just sliding towards disaster. I can see it, but I can't seem to stop it. So I grabbed him one day, and we were sitting in that little back room back there, and I said, let's go back to the beginning of this stuff. We talk a little bit about step one, and we talk a little bit about step two, and I said, you said that you and God were hip, and he said, yeah, and I said, who's your God? And he said, Satan? And I went, now I think we're getting someplace. We got to fix a couple of things. Because I don't think Satan wants you sober, brother. But we... That's a personal opinion. But so here's the deal. How many of you guys sat in meetings for years and you listen to guys going, I'm working on step two. I'm working, and then 6 months later, I'm working on that old step two. Listen, it's real simple. Do you believe that there's something out there that got the stars going and got the moon going and got everything all set up? Uh-huh. Great, let's go to step three. There it is. I mean, they didn't ask us to identify Him. They didn't ask us to put a full... I mean, it's like, I want a full-formed vision of what God looks like, feels like, everything. I want it all set up perfect before I buy into it. And that's what chapter 4, We Agnostics, starting on page 44 and run it for a ways, that's all they talked about in there, was trying to get us to knock down the contempt and the goofiness that we had around the ideas of things spiritual. Could we accept the fact that there's a God? Are we even willing to accept that there may be something out there? And that's good enough to make a beginning. And I've seen some busted up little buckaroos. I'm talking sick little units who simply, if you can just get there, you can make your beginning. And once you're there and God starts heading towards you and you feel pursued, it's just like, hang on, dude. It's coming, man. You're just going to... And it's an amazing thing to watch the transformation in their lives as they go through this kind of stuff. I lived it myself. I know exactly what it is to on one level, want to be a buddy of God, and on the other hand, would like to just bitch slap Him and walk out of the room. I know what it's like to be there. And the cool part about it is that once I just set down the contempt and the prejudice, amazing things happen. They really, really do. Turn over to page 60. Let's do something. I want to ask you guys a question real quick. Let's start at the ABCs, at the middle part of that thing. They're going to give us a little checklist before we head on. The steps are famous for this. They kind of make sure that everything is all greased up and where it's supposed to go, and then we'll head on down the road again. And it asks us, A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. There's no sense going on, guys, with any of this stuff if you're not convinced what your truth is around step one. If you're just misunderstood or you're just lonely, I got a list this long of places that you can get unlonely. Okay? I was at a skydiving place today, and these guys were falling out of planes with these girls and stuff, and it was the coolest thing in the world. I'm thinking, this would be a cool place. I could be unlonely doing that. Sure. And think of the time you'd save. No meetings, no 12-step work, no calls in the middle of the night. You touched what? I mean, trust me, it'd be a much easier way to go on this deal. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Guys, if there is the lurking notion, as in Fred's story, if there's the lurking notion that there's another way to do this, go try it first, please. Because it's so much nicer to do that. than to work a sponsor's butt off carrying you through this work, and you're going to do all this other kind of stuff, and then 6 months down the road saying, you know, I think I'm going to go try skydiving. Okay, why don't you go try skydiving first, and yoga and everything else you can think of, go do that. And then when you're done, come on, and we'll see what happens. The reason, we'll get there. I'm not going to get ahead of myself this tonight, for sure. And see that God could and would if He were sought. I always found that interesting. There was nothing in the C portion of that that said that we had to actually find God, that we had to define Him, that we had to do anything else. It just said if He were sought. I can seek. I'm a seeking kind of guy, man. I bet you guys are too. And that's all that they're requiring to be up to this point. And then being convinced that we were a step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to the care of God, over to God as we understood Him. I would just hold your finger on that thought for just a minute. In AA land, one of the very first things that I heard in the first or second meeting that I was in was, don't make any major decisions for the first year. Guys, do you realize how goofy that sounds in light of what we just read? You're getting ready to turn your will and life over to the care of a God you don't even understand. I'd say that's a major decision, wouldn't you? I would. I know some of you guys are going, well, you shouldn't judge people like that. This is what I'm talking about, guys. This is the vagarity of this thing that starts getting goofy on down the road. Where do you define it? Let's define it with sharp edges, what needs to be said and what doesn't need to be said. And that, I understand the sentiment. They're saying, man with tab A doesn't need to go with girl with slot B. You don't need to do that. I know what they're talking about, but dang, let's quit saying that stuff right now. Big decisions are okay. These kind of big decisions, they're okay like that. The rest of it we'll leave up to your sponsors, and if they want to do that, then they can do that. I understand the need for it. It's just this, you don't understand. Okay. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. By the way, let me mention something real quick. In the last week that we do this, almost the entire night, what we're going to do is talk about sponsorship and about how cool this stuff is. And I want to, as a caveat, as just a little side road real quick here, one of the slickest things I've seen in AA is healthy sponsorship that sets appropriate boundaries, and we're not all the same. Listen, I've had men that I sponsor that I have a little special leash that's about that long, and I'm holding it about that tight. I mean, these guys are just goofballs, and they're heading all crazy. And then you've got other guys that get healthy pretty quick, and you can let out a little more rope, and you know they're just healthier. And so you can't make sweeping, don't do this, don't do that. You can't do that because every man that you come across and every woman that you come across are different. Some people need more guidance than others do when they first get here. But we're going to talk specifically about that kind of stuff so that we can get clear on it, because there seems to be a lot of confusion around it. It says the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. That's couched more as a question. On that basis, we are almost always in a collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Let me ask you something. How many of you guys read this and thought it was pretty goofy when you first read it? Was I the only one in here that thought this whole piece was written out of place? I did. You have to understand, guys, up until this point, we've been talking pretty on point about alcohol and alcohol stuff and this sort of thing. And then it's like all of a sudden what Bill does is he sort of changes directions, and what they're talking about is self. But there's nowhere in the next two and a half pages where they talk anything about booze. They're not even addressing it. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, what is it? I always say that it seems to me like what they did was, is that at the end of this thing, when they got the book together, some dude in the back of the room goes, hey, Bill, I found this stuff over here. Is this part of it? And it's just some loose pages. And Bill goes, we intended, let's just stick it here. That's the way it feels. That's the way it reads when you're reading through it like this. Because the change is so abrupt where it takes us. But I understand now, I've gotten a little smarter with it over the years, and I see the wisdom in what he did. Had it been anyplace else, it would have been, it needed to be right where it was. It says, at the bottom, it says, most people live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. He's forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. Picture yourself on this page, guys, with these guys. My observations in sponsorship has been that if you can see your own selfishness in your life, you have a real good chance of getting free and clear of all of this. If you can't see the selfishness, if you're defensive about the idea that even if somebody would even consider you selfish, it may get bloody. It may just get really really uncomfortable before it gets better. And because breaking down those walls of I'm right and you're wrong is sometimes pretty hard to do. If you've built the case against everybody else, it could get pretty crazy like that. So see if any of this stuff that we read, we're going to skip through this stuff, but see if it resonates with anything that you've been through. What usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. Guys, I'm going to suggest you think about your last relationship with a woman right here, okay? Because it's easy to see. It's the easiest place to see our own selfishness and self-centeredness. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that the other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? The trick here is, men, is that there's not one woman in here that doesn't see that. I promise you. Because if you haven't figured it out, they're twice as smart as you are. And I guarantee you, they see every piece of this stuff. They see exactly what it is you're trying to do. You're trying to be all gracious and kind, and they're going, no, he's not. He's trying to manipulate me. Because that's what we do. And you know it too. In the deepest, darkest part of the night, you know exactly what you're doing. If I can say the right thing, she'll say yes. If I can just get her to touch it, it'll all be fine. You can say touch it. I didn't say anything else. I didn't say... But you're not sly. You didn't pull this over on it. The trick is that some of us spend an entire adult life doing exactly the same thing. And it's an amazing thing to see. Over and over and over again. We step on her and she retaliates. And then we get mad and she ends up on an inventory. And then we go find another one. She ends up on the inventory. And sometimes you look at these lists and you go down like, he tells me the story of the first piece of inventory. He tells me that we're like this. And I look down the rest of them and they're all exactly alike. And I'm just waiting for him to say that. And usually, sometimes if he's smart, he'll say, well, the rest of them are exactly alike. And I'm going to go, next, let's get on with this. Come on. So you got 60 pages of inventory that just got wadded down to about this much. I mean, it's nothing. Because we do the same thing over and over again. I think I'm being smart. Let me ask you a question. Men, how many of you guys could not be an absolute jerk and change on a dime to being nice if you think it'll get you something? When you realize the demonstrative approach is not working, how many of you guys know you can't? You just go, okay, it's not working. Let's try something else. Sweetheart, I'll cook dinner. I'll have it here for you. Right? Okay. This is what we're trying to see. What I don't want you doing is thinking that all these girls are whack jobs. They're not whack jobs. You are a whack job. Come on. And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate? Yes, snatching all they can, get out of the show. Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Man, have you ever meditated on that? Have you ever spent any time just sitting there early in the morning thinking about this? Am I a producer of confusion rather than harmony? It's my favorite line at work when I walk in the morning. Gentlemen, are we producers of confusion today or harmony? And they all look at the floor. So, flip back over to page 62. Greatest line in the big book and the most misunderstood for a lot of us. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Guys, I don't. Sometimes I just don't get this. It ought to be, what? Schlitz malt liquor and Seagram's VO. That's the root of all problems. Right? I mean, if they're asking me to write it, crack cocaine and, I mean, fill in the blank. I'm telling you right now, it ought to be that. And so this is where I started scratching my head going, what? Why would it be selfishness? Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. Guys, how many times have you looked back on your life and realized that you made decisions? At one point in time, I was able to look at my life and see clearly that I'd made a thousand decisions, and they'd all been based on two things: selfishness and fear. I'm afraid I'm going to lose something. It all goes back to self as the underlying cause of it. But I'm afraid I'm going to lose something. I get fearful, and she's going to leave me anyway. I'll dump the bitch. I mean, come on, God, how many times have we done that stuff? I'll get off the girl guy metaphor in a minute, but it works so well for this stuff because most guys can't lie about this stuff. They look back at the wreckage that is their life, and most of it is around relationship stuff. And that's why it's easier to see. Sometimes it's a little more subtle, but the point is, as long as I'm exerting my will, my right to have something a particular way, as long as I have a preconceived idea about how you're supposed to act based on self, I promise you, we got a collision course coming. It's going to get ugly. It's just a matter of when. When. And that's what we're trying to see. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourself, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. That's one of those musts that's not supposed to be in the book. There's another one. We must or it kills us. God makes that possible. Meetings. It didn't say meetings made that possible. It didn't say a sponsor made that possible. It said what? God made that possible. And this is an inside job, guys. Have you ever stopped to think? We're not born haters. We're not born bigots. We're not born selfish. We're not born that way. These are skills that we've honed from the time we're a little bitty kid. If I do this, I get this. If I do this, I get this. If I do this, I don't have to do that. You see, we manipulate our life around self. And for a while it works. Sometimes it works well. And that's the rub. And the only way to get rid of self is to get God in the middle of the picture. The illusion always is, if I exert enough self, I can get rid of self. And that's a fool's game. I'm telling you. I'm actually 28 years old. I just look bad like this because that's my life spent trying to exert enough self to get rid of self. And it'll always end ugly. Always has. We had to have God's help. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Flip over to the prayer on the next page. The top of that page on 63, they give us these little third step prayers. They start telling us a little bit of cool stuff about what we had a new employer being all powerful. He provided what we needed. What a great idea. If you've just come into this gig and you've been spending all your effort trying to put a lame deal together so you could coast another day or two, and then you could put another lame deal together. And sometimes our lives get really crazy. And this idea that we could actually get a creator involved in that life can be fairly amazing. Fairly amazing. The prayer at the middle of this thing, here again, I'm a little bit caught off guard that they didn't ask, that there's nothing in there about booze. I mean, this is Bill's big swan song prayer about getting rid of the booze deal. And they don't mention it. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as I will. Here it is. Relieve me of the bondage of self. If it's not underlined, do. That I may better do thy will. And it goes through the rest of the prayer. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Let me tell you, guys, my experience has been that in the morning when I get up, I don't care how long you've been sober, 1 week or forever, when you get up in the morning, it's not booze waiting for you. It's not been my experience. Self is waiting for you. You don't believe it? Stop and think about the last morning you got up. Stop and think about this morning. Some of you got up and you were little spiritual giants. Some of you guys got up and by the time you got to the bathroom, you're thinking who you're going to kill that day. I mean, it just, you ever, but stop and think about the progression and the nature of this part of this thing. How many times have you gone to bed a spiritual giant? You know, you took a deep breath and God's good and everything is all groovy, and then you go to sleep. And then you get up in the morning and you open an eye and you look over there like this, and there's a turned over glass on the nightstand, or something's not right. The windows haven't been washed in a while, and you're looking at the sun come through there and you're going, and it didn't take much. And all of a sudden it goes, click, and you get up and you head for the bathroom. It's only, what, 6 or 7 steps to the bathroom, and by the time you get there, you're already click, click. It's just getting twisted a little bit tighter, and you get there, go do what you got to do, come back out, and You understand what I'm saying? By the time you're eating Cheerios, you're sitting there shoveling them Cheerios in your mouth, and you're looking, you got that 100-yard stare, and you're just thinking, I'll kill him when I get to work. I'll just, and if traffic's not exactly the way you want it, it doesn't make any difference what the thing is. Spiritually, I'm getting killed inside. I'm a whack job, and I've only been up an hour. This is classic spiritual malady stuff. They're going to introduce it on page 64 on this thing. This is classic, classic stuff. And it must be dealt with. This idea that I can be free of booze and still be able to maintain a spiritual connection is tough. It may work for some guys, but for most guys that are wired like me and you, it isn't going to happen. Down at the bottom of page 64... We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup that caused our failure, being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us. We considered its common manifestations. And then it says resentment is the number one offender. That is the manifestation of self. Self is the key here still. It destroys more alcoholics than it goes on down through the whole deal. But from it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. That's pretty magic stuff right there, guys. So I don't have to manhandle life, and I don't have to exert a bunch of willpower. I don't have to stay sober today. There's no bootstraps to pull up. There's none of that. All I have to do is deal with the spiritual component of this thing that keeps drawing me back to the drink. Because remember, if I'm comfortable in my own skin, what do I need a stinking drink for? You see what I'm saying? If it's when I'm twisting in the wind, it's when I'm emotionally unhinged that I have to reach for something to fix that, because it worked great forever. The problem is, we have a head from the mental standpoint that won't ever tell us the truth about that situation. Yes, it worked when you're 17, but will it work when you're 27? Maybe not. Maybe not. If it still worked the way it did when you're 17, you might still be out there doing it. I would. Trust me, I would. But it didn't. It didn't. This stuff about killed me. And so, that's what they're looking at. I always love this stuff. Go back at the bottom of page 63. Let's set this thing up and we're going to get into this inventory real quick. Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. This is after we got up off our knees doing a third step with hopefully a sponsor that knows us and understands us, and we're going to go through this. And it says, next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning. Now, one of the craziest things I ever heard in AA, I wish that they could do a survey of how many people actually did inventories. It was my experience has been, in all of the men that I've sponsored over the years, what I find is that you have lots of guys that will tell you, yeah, I'll work those steps. And then when you start talking to them about inventory, they go, huh? And they kind of tilt their head like a dog does. You know, they just like what? They didn't do any of that. They did a third step, and then God's grace said, okay, we're going to give you a little running room here. You're going to feel better. And sometimes God's hand in that situation is pretty powerful. Sometimes it's pretty amazing what happens after that third step. And for a lot of us, it's good enough. Thank you. All of a sudden, I'm looking at inventory and I'm going, I don't want to stir any of this stuff up. I'm feeling pretty good right now. I understand that. The problem is, it never stays. You'll feel better for a while, and then you'll start to implode, and you'll be scratching your head and wondering what just happened. It can be pretty ugly. The interesting thing is that Bill and those guys, in their wisdom, wrote it the way we needed to hear it. The way it could be effective. Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. Now, what part of that said, next, we sat on our butt for 6 months and talked about an inventory that we hadn't even started yet? And we hear it all the time in AA land. People talking about, well, I know we're talking about the fourth step tonight. I'm intending to do that one of these days, but in 6 months later, they're going to be doing exactly the same thing. And the ugly part that happens here, guys, is we have a lot of people in AA that are acting as sponsors that let it happen. That don't understand the dangers of doing that. Remember the stuff on page 24? We won't remember the pain and suffering of even a week or a month ago. We don't have a lot of time here, guys. We're fighting an uphill battle. And every day that we don't do this, self is rearing its ugly head, life looms large, and it's getting ugly. It's getting crazy out there. It's like, y'all understand it, right? I mean, you watch men and women that we sponsor get better and better and better, and then all of a sudden they start falling off to one side or another. And we see this in AA land. I've watched it happen in meetings where I was sitting. And the weird part about this is that people start saying things like this. You'll hear this. Well, I know he's getting sicker, but Boozle drive him back in here. Why would you say that, you idiot? Why would you say that? I mean, Booz may not drive him back in. Guys, we bury him all the time. Sometimes they don't get a chance to come back in here. Why don't we accept the responsibility that we were too chicken shit to hold them accountable for the things that they were supposed to do, the things that the text asked us to do? That's the reality of this thing. We have a responsibility, and with that responsibility comes the ability to look at somebody and say, listen, slick, we ain't doing that. You're going to do this now, you've got 10 days to do this, and that's it. If you don't take it seriously, I got guys standing in line that can help. Sound cold? So what? It's life or death, and there is indeed somebody standing right behind him that needs the help. Right behind him. I don't have time to wait while you decide whether or not you want to play with us or not. You either do or you don't. If you don't, I love you. See ya. Let me introduce you to some skydivers. Big? I mean, it's just... Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. And then they talk about this house cleaning thing. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, that third step thing that we just did, it could have little permanent effect unless at once, there it is again, followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. Oh, okay. Somebody told me one time, said, if you ever want to know who you really are, lay down who you're not. And it's true. This inventory is about trying to discover and see what we really are, who we really are, and get rid of all of the stuff that's make-believe, all of the stuff that we've just kind of built up and propped up as our persona, who we are. You see? And so, remember, we got a head that's our enemy in this game. I got a head that will constantly tell me that I'm okay. That will constantly tell me that you're the turd in the punch bowl. It's always you. It's not me. It's always you. And so if I can get clear on the fact that, hey, wait a minute, maybe I'm the problem. Listen, I don't think there's anybody in here, man or woman, that doesn't like to stay, that wouldn't like to just remain the victim. Seriously, there's some downsides to being a victim, but there's also a real upside. In a place of being a victim, I don't have to do anything. I just have to sit and be a victim. And I'll deal with it in any number of ways. A lot of times it'll come out sideways in misbehavior of all kinds. It'll come out goofy. The trick is that in order for me to not be a victim, I'm not saying that there are no victims. Sometimes we just get crapped on. I understand that. But in order for me to not be a victim, it means that I have to look hard at stuff and I have to begin to see, wait a minute, was there a mistake that I made in this deal that put me in a position to be hurt? Were there things that I set up that would later become my downfall? The reality of this thing from a cosmic rule book situation is that people just don't come out of the wings and take a shot at us. It doesn't usually happen like that, guys. People take a shot at us because we did something. And what we're trying to do in the inventory is look at that particular thing. It's what it is that we did to set up the nightmare so that we can begin to see, oh yeah, yeah, I did that. No wonder she treated me that way. No wonder she left. I wouldn't stay with me either. You see, these are healthy things to be thinking, rather than, I can't believe she would leave me. Okay. What I want to do in 10 or 11 or 12 minutes, what I want to do is I want to address this inventory directly. And I want to look at it. In the book, they give us this four-column inventory. The three columns on 65 and the fourth column on 67, and they talk about this stuff. Let me ask you this. How many times have you been, you guys that have been around for just a little while, how many times have you been at a wind-up joint or a treatment center or jail or someplace where we go to carry the message, and somebody walked up and asked you to sponsor them? Now listen, at the moment that they ask you, there's a bunch of things going through your head. One thing is, yes! He asked me. And then there's another thing in there that's going, most of us will do this. The first thing I do is regret eating before I came. Sorry. The next thing that will come through your head is, an 8-hour inventory. We always think of what's coming down the road in terms of the time that I'm going to have to spend with this guy in order to do that. The interesting part of that is that the book itself sets up a timeline which begins. It's interesting how they lay it out there. They keep using words like launch and now and be. They want you to go. There's a momentum that's set, and they would like you to keep doing that. There's nowhere in here. I think there's one step after what, third step, where it asks you to slow down for just a second, but it's just for a second, and then it asks you to go on. It's not third step. It may be then. There's one of them where they give you a little bit of time to take a breather, and then you're right back in the middle of it again. But the point is this, is that we've created a monster here in AA land around these inventories. And so what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about the inventory itself. These inventories are about seeing your truth. They are not confessional. Okay? I want to make sure we're real clear here. If confession fixes alcoholism, then let's go join the Catholic Church, or let's go join another church, and let's go just find somebody to confess to. And then, will it make you feel better? Yes. But it won't do what this will do. And that's the reason why it's so important. This is not journaling. We're not interested in a life story. But we see a lot of this. Listen, there are a lot of treatment places. They'll give you a notebook when you check in, and while you're there, you're going to write your life story, and then you're going to read it. I'm not knocking any of it, guys, but it doesn't pass muster as an inventory, because it's not. It never said in this text that we were supposed to write an inventory that described our life entirely, that we were going to write a journal. Well, it started when I was born. And then just like this, and you're looking at hours and hours and hours. If you've ever sat through an inventory that was like that, it's horrible. It's painful to just turn the page. And then I was three. And in the beginning, I'm just going to go, I don't know whether to kill him and drag him off in the brush and pretend he didn't show up. I'll just deny he ever came. Here's what the deal is. They look at this. It says, taking a commercial inventory. Let's go. Therefore, we start on a personal inventory. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. This is what they're likening it to. An inventory on a retail level, a commercial level. It's like, I'm going to go into a store. I'm going to count the good stuff. I'm going to count the bad stuff. I'm going to see what's saleable, what's still good, what's not. It's real simple. Guys, I use this example every time I do this stuff, and it works pretty well. You have an inventory, and your inventory in a milk cooler, and the milk is bad in there. You see? We don't need to know or understand why the milk is bad. It's not important. You see what I'm saying? And this is what takes up so much time, and this is what makes the inventory there's too much information that we don't need. What we need to know is milk, bad. Next. See what I'm saying? We don't need to know all the detail on it. My experience has been this, is that if you go on and on and on trying to set up a story to tell me a piece of information, I got pulled over by the cops in Garland. So I hate those guys. Okay? And so I'm gonna tell you, see, I got up and then I had these words with my girlfriend, and then it just didn't work out the way. I was gonna go pick up my car and the car wasn't ready, and so I stewed about that for a little while. And then as I was peeling out, trying to get clear of this car dealership, the cop was just sitting right there. They knew I was upset, they didn't have to do this stuff. You see what I'm saying? I'm going slick, stop. Dude, I don't need to know any of that stuff. Milk, sour, you got a ticket. That's it. That's all I need to know. I don't need to know why. The reality is that anytime you have to listen to people explain this stuff, they're not explaining it for clarity. They're explaining it to justify their bad behavior. Trust me on this, guys. I know some of you guys are sitting here going like, oh, I don't believe that. Trust me on this, guys. They're just trying to get you to see why they did what they did so they won't look like a selfish, self-centered jerk. And that's exactly what they'll look like if they tell you that they peeled away from the auto dealership and got a ticket. They broke the law. They got a ticket. Next. You see, this is what we're trying to get clear of. This idea that we could spend hours and hours and hours describing all of this stuff. There's enough drama as it is, guys. It's going to take a little while anyway. Just from personal experience, I've listened to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of inventories, and not one of them has lasted over 2 hours. And the one that lasted close to 2 hours was 66 pages of inventory. But buddy, I'm not going to listen to BS, and I'm not going to listen to justifying stuff. I'm not. When you start going, oh, time out, slick. Next. Come on. I understand it. Next. Next. And some guys go, well, I want to tell you about this stuff. Oh, I don't need to know this stuff. It's not important. It has nothing to do with the bigger picture here. I'm going to get ready, and when we get over to this fourth column, flip over to page 67. Let's start at the bottom of page 66, because this is key. This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Let me ask you a question. I was just talking to a guy a minute ago about this stuff. Have you ever, I know y'all don't look this way, but have you ever done anything that was just totally boneheaded? Just stupid. Am I the only guy that ever had? I mean, I got a whole bunch of that stuff. And I'm world famous for doing and saying stupid things. But what's the first thing when I do or say something stupid? What's the very first thing that I want? Compassion, forgiveness, understanding. I want all of these things from you immediately because I don't want to be where I am. And so this is what these guys are saying. We realize that the people who wronged us, I'm not saying that people didn't do crazy things to us here, guys. They were perhaps spiritually sick. Now, there's an interesting thought. Though we did not like their symptoms, that's column 2, or the way these disturbed us, that's column 3, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick man, a sick friend. There's a resentment prayer. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man, how can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry, thy will be done. And then look down, skip a paragraph, and then look at the one where it starts out, referring to our list again. This is the beginning of our fourth column. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. That's one time they ask us to do that. We resolutely look for our own mistakes, not part mistakes. Please stop saying, I'm looking at my part. I tell you why. One, it doesn't say that. And two, if we say we're looking at our part, there's an automatic implication that you had a part. And you may not have had. You understand what I'm saying? I do boneheaded things all the time. That's just me and myself. It had nothing to do with you guys, you see? And that's the reason why it's important. That's the reason why it was written like that. We're looking for our own mistakes. Where we've been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. Those are clear-cut questions that they're asking in that relationship. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though the situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. That's twice in that paragraph that they've asked us to disregard this other guy's deal. I don't care if it was 100% justified. I don't care if he walked up and called you a turd and you were retaliating. I don't need to know any of that. That's not important. What's important is your reaction to what he said. What is it that you did? And then we're going to look why you did it. Wasn't it because self was interfered with? You had a role. He's my friend. He shouldn't talk to me that way. Oh, really? Why? You see, I got these expectations bouncing around in my head, and I assign them to everybody, and you better play them. You better play them exactly the way I laid them out, or we're going to be upset. Let me ask you, let's look at parents. Real quick, let's just look at parents. How many of you guys, listen, I wanted desperately June Cleaver for a mom. I want a mom that walks around the kitchen in high heel shoes and pearls and cooks dinner. That's it. What I got was an angry feminist bra burner for a mom. You see? I didn't pick her. I wanted Ward Cleaver. I wanted somebody to take me to the baseball games and do this, and I got what? I got an alcoholic dad who was MIA, the kindest man I've ever known, gentle as he could be. Just not there. You see what I'm saying? I didn't pick this stuff, you see? So it's like I don't resent my parents because they were jerks. I resent my parents because they weren't playing the role that I assigned. You see? And if I can see it from that perspective, I want them to be a particular way and they're not. That's selfish. And if I can see that, then I can begin to let my guard down a little bit. I can relax my shoulders a little bit. I don't have to be so defensive. I can simply begin to own the wreckage of my existence. Yes, booze caused part of it, but not all of it. Most of the wreckage in my life was not directly caused by the booze. It was caused by me needing to have my way in every area of my life. You will do this or it'll be hell to pay. I'm not actually saying it that way, but that's what my actions are showing over and over and over again. And you guys are clear on that, right? And so as we begin to look at this thing, as we begin to look at this inventory, what we begin to see is who the authentic you really is. And I guarantee you guys, most of us are kind of warty looking. I mean, when we're looking at us in real form and we see that it's not all pretty. there is some pretty there, but there's also some ugliness there. There's some things that you kind of go, like, it's like the whole time I was raised up, I used to get beat up all the time. I'm a scrawny kid with a big mouth, and that's a bad combination. It is. And so I used to get the crap kicked out of me all the time. And so I hated bullies. Guess where I ended up as an adult? I'm the worst kind of bully. I'm pushing my wife around. I'm pushing my daughter around. I'm so consumed with fear and anxiety and frustration, and I can't stand it. And so I retaliate the only way I know how. I just get physical. In the last 6 months that I drank, I touched everybody in my life. I was pushing everybody. And it was ugly. I had become exactly what I didn't want to be. A big old stinking bully. And so once you face this stuff, you go, holy cow. I remember I finished this inventory with Clifford. This was the third inventory I'd done. And this was the first time I'd ever done it out of the book. And I sat back there and I wept and wept and wept. It was the most painful thing in the world. I'd been telling myself all these years that I was just a bit misunderstood, that I was okay, and I hadn't had a drink in 7 years, and that it was okay, and that I was really a little sunbeam for Jesus. Only people couldn't see that. And the reality was, I was just a jerk. Just a big old bully. And so when I saw all this stuff, I just cried. And I said, Clifford, what am I going to do? And he kind of looked at me and he said, we got the perfect thing. It's called 6 and 7. You see? And that's where we'll start next week. And we'll kind of get into the crux of the miracle part of this. How do we deal with an unlovely life as we begin to uncover and then try to discard that which we've brought into this picture? And the important thing for you to see and understand as you look around the room, I think sometimes we miss it, is that I said one time I wish we could stand back and take pictures of everybody when they came in. I've been here long enough to see a lot of you when you got here. And listen, when I look at you now and I see how well you clean up and I see how you smile, and more importantly, I see how unselfish you are in your ability to give and carry a message and go do something for somebody else. Collectively, we're the most selfish people on God's green earth. Categorically, we have been from the beginning of time. And you sit in a room and you look around and you see all these people that are willing to give of their time and energies to go try to help somebody else have a better day, and it's nothing short of a miracle. Wholesale. It's a perfect miracle. I'm glad to be in the room with you. I guarantee you I'll see you next week. Thank you.